But climate change, of course, has a lot of impact closer to home. I'm joined now by Nicola Chashilev from Greenpeace to discuss the issue. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
So, I mean, climate change is a topic that, you know, we talk about over and over again, but where do we stand with it right now at this point in time?
So, at the moment, the world has warmed about a bit over a degree above the temperatures in pre-industrial times. To put that into perspective, I mean, there is no safe level of warming, but the targets that are genuinely accepted are between 1.5 and 2 degrees to maintain the kind of ecosystems and the lifestyle that we're used to on planet Earth at the moment. So we're projected to go well over 2 degrees in business as usual if we don't cut back on the production of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases from fossil fuels. So there's a lot of work to do in things like getting more renewable energy online and cutting back global emissions. Because if we don't, the impact could be quite serious.
And obviously, the impacts that, you know, we all see and think about are things like melting ice caps and weather effects. But what are the unseen effects of climate change?
Look, there's so many out there. It's perhaps worth just talking about a couple of the biggest ones. Something that people may have heard of is the impact, for example, on the Great Barrier Reef. So as you get more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, temperatures warm, and that warming water causes the coral in the reef and other reefs around the world to bleach. If the temperature doesn't go back down in the short term quickly enough, then that coral will die. And in 2016 to 2017, we had 2 years in a row of the worst coral bleaching in the history of the Great Barrier Reef, where you know, close to half of the coral cover in the northern half of the reef died. That's something that you don't see in your day-to-day life, but it's just one example of the kind of havoc that climate change is already having. Another really prominent example is extreme weather. So as the oceans warm, as the atmosphere warms and the oceans warm too, you get more intense hurricanes because they're caused and driven by warm ocean temperatures in the tropics. And we've had many of them in the last few years in the Pacific and in Southeast Asia that have been devastating for loss of life and huge damage to people's livelihoods and property. Those are the kind of things that we're talking about. It's not just about the environment, but it's about the impact on people's lives and their ability to live their lives.
Now, much of what's contributed to climate change, like coal power and forest exploitations, has also basically fueled the entire development of many of the world's powerful nations today. Can developing nations become wealthier and more stable through more eco-friendly methods?
Absolutely, they can. The challenge of climate change is a challenge, but it's also an opportunity. There is a question of global equity there, and you're absolutely right to say that developed countries now exploited the environment and caused the climate crisis, but everybody pays for it, and the least developed countries are paying for it most of all because they have the least ability to adapt. But there's huge potential in areas like renewable energy, decentralized renewable energy networks to provide the power, for example, that the developing countries need for new industries and new cities. That's clear. In the same way that, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, people went straight to mobile phones. They didn't go to set up a landline infrastructure first. They jumped straight from an area with little phone infrastructure to everybody using mobile phones. We can do this in the developing world as well, but we don't need to go through a carbon-intensive mm-hmm. industrialization.
So we can kind of use the lessons we've learned to skip right past that and work already from a place of knowing how to avoid it.
Absolutely, yeah.
And Nicola, we still obviously, I mean, it seems ridiculous to have to talk about it all the time, but, you know, it's still an age of denial where we hear over and over how people, there's a debate over climate change. People are arguing over whether it's real. Is it actually possible to effectively combat climate change when we're still spending so much energy on trying to say, like, yes, it exists and it has real effects?
Look, I think it absolutely is because the science is unequivocal that climate change is real and mm-hmm. it's being caused by human activity. And what you're seeing in that, so the false debate there, is people who are in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry, mm-hmm. who take political donations from them and in various other ways, who are just pushing an agenda that they've been paid to push. And so the debate is kind of a false one. But what's interesting is that when we go out and do public polling of what Australians think about renewables and climate, they see through it. You know, fully 96% in a recent poll of Australians believe that renewables should be the primary source of energy in Australia. That's just one example, but people are starting to see through it. But you know, we need to tackle the entrenched sources of power that are creating that false debate.
How real are the consequences? However false this debate is, how real are its consequences?
Well, I think you see it in federal politics, for example, right now, where there is a push by the right of the government and the Liberal Party and the National Party to try, for example, to have the government fund and build a new coal-fired power station. It's completely absurd. It makes no economic sense. It's destructive for the environment. But these handful of members of parliament are trying to use this as a divisive issue. It's not going to work, but it does set us back somewhat in actually taking the action we need when we're still engaged in this false debate about whether coal is good or not. The evidence is in that we can't have any coal in our energy mix if we want to protect ourselves from climate change.
So, Nicola, can I ask you a little bit about what the role of Greenpeace is in all of this?
Absolutely. So we're an international organization present in over 40 countries around the world. And we campaign on climate change across the board, whether that's trying to stop brown coal-fired power plants and mining in parts of Germany to dealing with extreme weather impacts in the Pacific, stopping tar sands pipelines in North America. And in Australia last year, Greenpeace was central to a winning campaign that got the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, the largest in Australia and one of the largest in the world, to commit to not financing any new coal projects. And that's, you know, those sort of wins, those sort of impacts are the kind of things that we fight for every day. And as part of a big climate movement around the world, I'm confident that we can get the change that we need. But it's not just up to individual organizations. Everybody has a role to play. And the only way that we're going to be able to combat the power of the fossil fuel industry and its supporters in government is by mobilizing the power of ordinary people who care about their lives and the lives of their children and want to live in a healthy planet.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Nicola, for joining us this morning to talk about it.
Not at all. Thank you so much.